All right, very good. So I think that's it. Let me slide over here and get this. So this week's Parsha is Tetzaveh. And so if you'll turn to Exodus chapter 26, we'll start in verse 20. And there is a lot in this Parsha. We probably won't get, we definitely won't get to it all. But just a few things that I want to talk about as we do each week. Let's see. All right, Exodus chapter 27, verse 20. How is everyone today? Everybody seems kind of sleepy. Everybody okay? Everybody all right? I mean, just taking it all in. All right, so I was able to, this week, was able to join Barry Phillips on Hebrew Nation Radio, Foundations for Life, and we spent 2 hours talking about Tetzaveh and didn't even, neither one of us felt like we either scratched the surface. And I want to thank you for those of you who tuned into that and sent me messages afterward that you enjoyed it. And then I will be on again with Barry this coming Wednesday, 4 hour time, Hebrew Nation Radio, Foundations for Life, talking about Ki Tisa. And it's just basically a 2 hour conversation about the Parsha, and it's a lot of fun. And they're also archived on the Hebrew Nation Radio website, or you can subscribe to Hebrew Nation Radio as a podcast and get all of the stuff that comes through there. So, all right, so we start in verse 20, and it says, Tetzaveh, now you shall command. So one of the interesting things to write off in the first few words is that last Parsha, what was the name of last week's Parsha? How many of you remember? Terumah, right? And what is Terumah? It's a free will offering, right? Or a heave offering, but it's a free will offering. And the whole point of Terumah is that each man would give out of his heart what he felt to give, what he chose to give, okay? And the idea is that not that Moses would take an offering, but would receive the offering that people would determine in their own hearts to give. So if you didn't want to give, you weren't obligated to. And if you wanted to give tons, you could give tons. In the opening part of this Parsha, we have a different thing altogether. And God says, now you shall command. So the other one you could give if you want, this one you have to. This is a commanded offering, okay? A commanded offering of clear olive oil, crushed for illumination, to kindle, and mine says a lamp continually. Does anybody say the lamp? Yeah, the lamp? All right. The stone says a lamp. Well, a lamp, the lamp. What lamp are we talking about? The menorah, right? The menorah, right. So this is for burning the, for supplying the menorah with oil. In the tent of meeting outside the partition that is near the testimonial tablets, or the Aron HaKodesh, the Ark of the Holy Ark of the Covenant. Aaron and his sons shall arrange it from morning to evening, an eternal decree for their generations, from the children of Israel. So this lamp, the menorah, was to burn continually. Now, in our English, that sounds like it never was to go out ever, always to burn day and night, 24/7. But in the Hebrew, that word is tamid. That it doesn't mean never to go out ever. It means that it's to be done daily and not in a broken pattern. So it was to be done every day, was to be lit. The priest would come in, he would trim the wicks, he would fill the oil, he would light the menorah, and that was part of the daily service. So there are a lot of the menorah study could, and there are people that have done studies. Voluminous, I guess, is a word. You can use it. You're welcome. Voluminous studies on the menorah and what it means, and you have the seven branches and what does that represent, and you have some people on one end that say, what was the purpose of the menorah? And for those of you who are really practical and really logical in here, what would be the purpose for a big seven branch candelabra? To give light. Okay, let's move on, right? And that's one side of the spectrum, and a lot of people look at it and go, it was a big light, okay? And then on the other side of the spectrum, the menorah was almost not even a reality because it was so endued with meaning that, you know, you have seven branches, you have the seven spirits of God, you have the oil and the spirit and the, you know, the fire and the flame and the light and the, all these symbols and all this imagery that comes out, and there's layers and layers and layers and layers and layers of things. The place to start when we're studying temple, tabernacle, any of these ancient things is, what would the people have understood? This big seven-branched candlestick, what would they have thought? Would they be thinking seven spirits of God, light, the word, Yeshua? Would they be thinking all that? Probably not. They would have been thinking it's a big, gaudy light because this is the temple of our king. And it had all these, you know, decorations and all these kinds of things. Now, does it have those other layers of meaning? Yeah, absolutely. But I've heard this. I've heard these types of symbology teachings twisted so much that it makes the original thing not even mean anything. So, so do some study. It is good. It's a beautiful picture of what we see come to pass later on, and a lot of history in the menorah. And of course, you can get online and you can see all the pictures of what they think the menorah looked like, and even one that the Temple Institute has deemed okay for, you know, for future use. The point here is that last week's parsha was a free will offering. This week is a commanded giving. You had to bring oil. You had to bring oil to supply the lighting of the menorah. That was on the people. That was their responsibility on the people, and not just a one-time offering. That was a continual, daily or weekly, every time you had to bring. And that's a sacrificial giving. That's a sacrificial thing. Now, I want to get into verse in chapter 28. The first few words, it says, "Now you," speaking of Moshe, "bring near to yourself Aaron your brother and his sons." Bring near Aaron and his sons. So this is the calling of, the beginning of Aaron becoming the high priest. And the question that Barry asked on the program last week was, how much convincing do you think Moses had to do for Aaron to be this high priest? How much? What's the backstory here? What's going on, like, underneath the text? What's going on in real life? So Moses is telling Aaron, like, you're gonna come be the high priest, and is Aaron's attitude, okay, great, like, let's jump in there and do it, or is he like, wait, you want me to do what now? You want me to stand in the presence of God? What, say that again? What happens? I don't get any land. I don't, you know, all these conversations that happen. One thing I want to focus on this is the word to bring near, or the phrase to bring near. He said, "You bring Aaron near," and it's interesting that phrase is there. I'm not sure what other translations you have, but the word there, the Hebrew word there, is karav, K-A-R-A-V. Karav is to bring near. So picture this and how cool this is. So you have Moshe bringing near Aaron as the first high priest, right? Karav, to bring near. When you hug your grandchildren, you draw them up close, that's karav. You're bringing them near, right? Your children, your grandchildren. When you hug your spouse, you bring them in close, a tight hug. That's karav. That's to bring near. Now, there's another word in the Bible that is actually in the New Testament in Mark 7. Yeah, Mark 7, chapter 11. And Yeshua is dealing with these old rotten Pharisees. And there's an issue there. And there's a word that shows up that it seems like we never knew what it was. Karban. Korban. Korban is derived from the Hebrew word karav that we see here. Well, what is korban? And korban can be spelled with either a C or a K. What is a korban? We've talked about this. It's been months, and I know you've slept since then, so you probably don't remember. But what is a korban? What does that mean? What is the meaning of that? Or how do we translate it in our Bibles? It's an offering, are a sacrifice. All of the sacrifices given in the tabernacle and in the temple, the whole big group, are known as karbanot. Karbanot in plural. All the sacrifices, all the offerings. Why is this important? Because when we think of sacrifice and we think of offering, we think of giving up something. We think of pain. This is going to cost me something. I don't want to do this, but I have to. We think of sacrifices, somebody yanking something away from it, tearing something away from a sacrifice. I don't want to let it go. A sacrifice hurts, right? But the sacrifices, the offerings that were given in the Mishkan and the Beit HaMikdash, they were karbanot. They were offerings and sacrifices. Karbanot, the root word is karav, which means to what? To bring near. So the offerings and sacrifices were not that God was punishing the people because he was trying to take all their stuff in the way that we kind of think about it. It was a way for them to draw near, to come close, to draw near. It's that idea of scooping up your kids or grandkids and holding them close, that drawing near. So when we read in the Brit Hadashah about you offer your body as a living sacrifice, a living korban, our purpose should be drawing near to God and bringing others near. That's the living sacrifice part. How do you be a living sacrifice? Well, that it's the idea of drawing near. That's the whole point of sacrifices in the first place, is to bring the people together, to bring the people close to God. And Aaron, as the high priest, the first high priest, he is kind of the prototype in this, or he's giving the model for this as he's drawing near. Whenever he's when in the first part of chapter 28, I love that tie-in, and I think that's really powerful. I want to read a quote from a commentary that I think is really interesting. It says, "It is true that the tribe of Levi, who did not participate in the Synod of Golden Calf, and the Kohanim, so Levi and the Kohanim, the priests, are in many respects separate hereditary castes. So you have the high priest, Aaron and his sons, and then you have the rest of the priests. Remember, all priests are Levites, but not all Levites are priests. Remember that? Like all fingers are thumbs, but not all thumbs are fingers. You know what I mean. So they were separate hereditary castes. Nevertheless, it remains the case that the idea of social structure of the Israelites, as envisioned in the Torah, is remarkably free of social hierarchies and inequalities that characterize even the most democratic societies. So the idea is that while you may have had a high priest and priests and then the laity, that is something that we kind of put on the Torah. It wasn't that the high priest was up here and was somebody to be oogled and googled over, and then the priests were somebody to be served. What was the whole point of the priesthood? It was to serve, right? The high priest would not be driving the Jaguar or the Mercedes or the BMW of his day, okay? Just saying. Just food for thought. It goes on to say, in particular, Israelite society is envisioned as one that would be free of any kind of extensive hierarchical network of full-time religious functionaries who act as intermediaries between the people and God, and whose service before their passive congregants takes the place of the individual's personal relationship with God. Let me read that again. The Israelite society, as envisioned in the Torah, is one that should be free of any kind of extensive hierarchical network. Okay? No big I's and little U's. Of full-time religious functionaries. That's a big way to say full-time ministry. Okay? Who act as intermediaries between the people and God, and whose service, I love this phrase, whose service before their passive congregants. Let me just ask you a question, and I'll let you deal with the answer personally. Are you a passive congregant? Well, we're here, ain't we? Well, showing up is half the battle, but just something for you to, and I'm not being critical, I'm just asking, are you a passive congregant? One of the one of the things that I got, let's just do some family housekeeping here. Why do you groan? Because I know you. As a worship leader, you have to understand that when someone is leading worship, whether it's me or any, whoever else it is giving 1,000% everything. And I know there's worship. I've gotten a lot of flack over the years because older ministers, and I've had older ministers tell me several times, you should look at everybody when you're worship, when you're leading worship, when you're singing. And my response is, I'm not worshiping them. I don't. My attitude towards worship leading has always been, I'm going somewhere. I would love for everybody to come with me. But my responsibility is not to drag you into worship, is not to drag you like a, I think I said this the other day, like a B-52 down the runway and get you into the presence, into the heavenlies where I'm going. That's not my job. That's your job. So in worship, are we being passive congregants? And I don't mean that everybody has to run circles around the building, you know, or form a dancing line, a conga line. I'm not envisioning a particular appearance. You know, I don't want us to look like a charismatic church or look like a Pentecost or look like a Baptist. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm saying is, are you engaging? I don't know because my eyes are closed. I don't know. I hear somebody singing every once in a while, and that's kind of cool. But I don't. But are you passive? The worship part of our service is only as fulfilling as you will make it. It's your time. It's your time. That's why I say you can go in the corner if you want. You can go up. You can come up here. You can go wherever. It's completely free and open. You can lift your hands. You can nod. Whatever. It's open. But are you engaging? Passive congregants. All right, I'll hit one more just because I feel like it. Part of the purpose and the reason for a fellowship is taking a little bit from the tabernacle and the temple. It's the place that we draw near. It's the place that we karav, that we come together, right? A kehillah, a gathering. This building and no other building with a steeple or a cross or a whatever on it, or a mezuzah for that matter, no other building is the house of God. We have to understand that. This is not the house of God. There's one house of God. And in the Tanakh, it was here on the earth. In the Brit Hadashah, it was destroyed for the last time in 70 AD. Now it's in heaven. Some people think that it'll come back. It may not. We're not going to get into debate about what you think about the third temple. But there is a house of God. And that house of God has very strict protocols in how you treat it and how you are when you are there. This is a building. It's got four cracking walls and a leaky roof, and it is what it is. But it is the place that we dedicated to come together. It's the place that we set apart to come together as a family. The whole point of this building, of us sitting in these chairs and all of this, is not so we can get filled up with knowledge and so that we can become so arrogant and so puffed up that we know all, we know some Hebrew words and we know blah blah and we do this and we do that. There's no point. The whole purpose is to karav, is for us to draw near and for us to draw near to each other and hopefully for us to draw those people in our world near. That's the whole purpose, is to karav. So let me just fuss at y'all a little bit and say that when someone new comes into this building, they should never be sitting by themselves. Ever. You guys have no idea how it irks me when I see somebody sitting by themselves. Now, there's some times that I go into a place, I want to be by myself, and I get that. So if somebody wants to be by themselves, that's cool. Respect their boundaries. But the idea that we are to be one group together, karav. We are to bring and draw near and draw close. Because if how many of you have said, or how many times have we heard people come visit and say, I've been looking I'm looking for a group like this forever. I thought I was the only one. For years I've been studying Torah and trying to live the feast, and I didn't know there was anybody else around here doing that. And so we're like, yay, you found us. It's awesome. Come in, have a seat. You know, it's great. Be a part of the fellowship. And a couple weeks later, they're gone. One of those reasons may be because they just didn't fit, and that's fine. There's nothing we can do about that. But that reason better not be because we didn't connect them and we didn't make them feel apart. Does that make sense? That we didn't karav them, that we didn't draw them near. We do what we can do. God will do what we can't do. But it's our responsibility to make sure that this is home for whoever walks through that door. So this, the idea of Aaron drawing near is a prototype of not only what the congregation and the Israel would do, but what I believe we are to do here, even as a taking from that. So the Kohens, the Kohenim, the priest, the high priest, were never to take their place or take the place of their a passive congregants and their individual personal relationship with God. Just for schnitz and schniggles, this is a Jewish commentary that I'm reading from, which I think is really fascinating. How many Sundays did we sit there and I tell you all the time, this is not that, this ain't that, where we're going to come in together and open up your head and Joe's going to just fill it with information, you close it back up and you walk out the door. That's not what this is. This is active participation. I'll finish this quote. Nonetheless, it remains true that despite their exclusive role in the temple sacrificial services and in the purification from leprosy, the Kohenim were not religious intermediaries who in some sense replaced the personal connection of the individual with God. And I think that is wonderfully said. All right. So we have the drawing near of Aaron and the priests, and that began. And then we have an explanation of the vestments. We have the ephod with the three colors, remember, that we talked about last week, and the linen, which is the word shesh, S-H-E-S, shesh, and the breastplate. The breastplate is interesting. Well, first of all, before we do that, let's start in verse 4. And these are the, what's your word there? Say it again. Garments? Vestments? Yeah, vestments is such a... We all should start using that word. Hey, nice vestment. So the Hebrew word for vestment or for garments here is beged. Beged is garments. All right, let's scramble some brains a little bit. So the word beged in Hebrew doesn't really mean garment. In the sense that we think of it, it doesn't mean like a t-shirt and jeans, okay? The word beged in Hebrew means treachery or deceit. So how do we get garments, the idea of garments, from treachery and deceit? Well, let's think back all the way back to Adam and Chava, right? They rebelled. And they were clothed because they were naked, right? The idea of clothing all through antiquity is to hide or to change the identity of who you really are. We see this in clothing all the way through the scriptures. I got a list here. So Adam and Chava, Rivka dresses Yaakov, right, in Esau's garments. Leah wears bridal garments and deceives Yitzhak in marriage. Yosef's brothers, right, and the coat of many colors, the multicolor, multi-length robe, however you want to think about that. Potiphar's wife and Joseph and the garment. Tamar deceives Yehuda into thinking she's a harlot, right? This dress over and over and over and over and over. You have these. The scripture interplay and garments are very, very, very important. Even in the Gospels, garments are very important. Even in Paul's writings, the put on Messiah, right? That it's a garment language, I guess we could say. So in all of these vestments, these are called the golden vestments. In all of these vestments, there becomes a question. So when Aaron puts on these vestments, this beautiful, and as a matter of fact, I think we have in, it's either in Josephus, that when the king of let's see, I don't think I have it in my notes. That when the king of Anyway, the king of somewhere. we'll check it later. During the Maccabean revolt, I think it was the Greek king. When he came, the Israelites sent the high priest out to greet him. It was Alexander. I knew it started with an A. Thank you. It was Alexander that sent the high priest out to meet him. And Alexander was so impressed with the gold investments that he got off of his horse. Alexander the Great got off of his horse and bowed before the Kohen Gadol because he was so impressed with these gold investments. That's how big a deal these garments are. Okay. Verse 4 says, they make a breastplate, an ephod, a robe, a tunic, a box knit, a turban and sash, and they shall make vestments of sanctity for Aaron, your brother, and his sons to minister to me. So if the word garment means treachery and deceit, but you have these golden garments, these beautiful garments being used in temple service, how do we justify those two? So when Aaron puts on the garments of the Kohen Gadol, is he disguising himself and tricking everyone else into, this is who I really am? You know what I mean? This is my office. This is who I may be a complete, you know, butt nugget everywhere else, but this is who I really am. Now you have to respect me as this Kohen. Even though I treat everybody like trash, when I wear these, you have to respect me because I'm the man of God. So is it that kind of thing, or is it something else happening? Well, we read later on in the Parsha that these garments are to be for glory and splendor. Kavod and Tiferet. Glory and splendor. The idea of the golden vestments as it relates to the Kohenim is that the golden vestments were what was sanctified. The clothes is what was set apart. And when Aaron or the high priest after him would put on the garments, they would elevate the man to the position where he could serve. And I know that gets maybe a little wacky, but it's really not. The clothes elevated the man to the position he could serve. So let me ask you this. If you go to Walmart in sweatpants and an old stained t-shirt and some flip-flops one day, and then the next day you go in a suit and $500 shoes, do you walk differently through Walmart based on what you're wearing, based on those two different outfits? Probably so. If I were to stand up here, or a teacher were to stand up here in some old stained sweatpants, and I use sweatpants because I think they're deplorable in public, and an old nasty t-shirt and, you know, some, you know, barefoot or whatever, versus someone who stands up here in a tuxedo, there's a different interaction, a different interplay there that happens with the person wearing the garments first. I carry myself differently when I'm wearing a suit. It just happens. I don't try to do it. It just is what it is. Some of it may be this, but there's a difference in the way that you carry yourself depending on what you're wearing. It just is part of the way it works. And so the gold investments in priority were to remind Aaron of the majesty and the glory, the kavod, literally the, we don't know what glory means, the weight. That's what kavod means, the weight, the heaviness of this responsibility he had. So the garment is not trying to cover up who Aaron is. It's trying to remind Aaron who he's supposed to be. It's not about covering up the sinful, rebellious human part of Aaron. It's to get Aaron to remember, if I'm going to wear these garments, I need to be worthy of these garments. Like being worthy of the calling, being worthy of putting on Messiah. And so it elevates Aaron in his own personal being and also in the eyes of the people. And that doesn't mean that when you take these garments off, you can act like some old wretch. It is to transform who you are and to be a reminder to elevate you to worth of service. And so we have the gold investments, we have the ephod, the settings, the breastplate of mine says the breastplate of judgment. Some describe it as the breastplate of judging matters, discernment. And the breastplate is a mysterious kind of thing because you have the two stones, the two onyx stones, right, with all 12, the names of 12 tribes, which here's another little nugget. Where are they placed? They're placed on the shoulders, right, on Aaron's shoulders. You know how I love to talk about Israel being the kingdom, right, and the Torah being the constitution of the kingdom? When God pulls Israel out of Egypt, he's setting up a new government. That's a lot of what the Torah is a new government. This is how you're going to act with each other. This is what we're going to do and not do, okay? And don't be boneheads to each other. He's setting them up a government. This government, this nation has how many pieces to it? 12, right? So the 12 pieces of the government are etched on these stones on the shoulders of Aaron, the high priest. And in... let's see, where is that? I think this is interesting because in Isaiah chapter 9, it says, a child is born, a son will be given, and the government will be on his shoulders. The government will be on his shoulders. How is the government represented in the book of Exodus? The 12 tribes. The nation of God, the kingdom, the nation. Why are the tribes so important? Because they are the kingdom. Aaron carries the weight of this new government on his shoulders as the Kohen Gadol here on earth. We are told that Messiah will carry the government on his shoulders as the high priest after the order of Melchizedek. All right, so a lot more about the breastplate, the Urim and the Tumim, which is just fun to say. And then you have the ephod, the head plate, the crown that says Kadosh Yod Heh Vav Heh, the tunic. And then we have the inauguration with the immersing and the sacrifices, the rams and the all that. And then we have the incense offering. We've done some study on the incense offering. You can go back and check that out. Strange Fire, the incense offering, is really, really profound and something that you should take some time to look at. But we're out of time for that today, so we are going to move on. And I'll leave that up to your personal responsibility. All right. Sorry.